1 month ago, there was a shooting at Mattoon High School in Central Illinois. With one student opening fire in the cafeteria, another student was injured.
We are saddened that this event has happened, and we will provide counseling to our students in need. We will continue to work with our emergency personnel to determine what happened.
That's Mattoon Superintendent Larry Lilly at the time. Today, how students and the rest of the community are coping. Plus, the Illinois River has been polluted for decades, but for the first time in more than a century, its native sport fish have come back, and in record numbers. And like it or not, pumpkin spice season is here, and it's really just everywhere. It's not just your lattes or your pumpkins. We're going to present some other fall spice alternatives for you. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 1 month ago, a student at Mattoon High School shot and injured another student in the cafeteria. The shooter was eventually subdued by a teacher and was taken into police custody. The victim was taken to a local hospital. The next day, nearly 200 people attended a candlelight vigil in Mattoon. The school said that any absences that day would be excused, and Superintendent Larry Lilly said he'd make sure students would be able to get the counseling that they needed. After traumatic events like a school shooting, everyone from police to school administrators to local media springs into action. But once that immediate shock is over, how does life get back to normal? Does it? And how do you make sure that not just students, but everyone feels supported in the weeks and months later? In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about that with Karen Sims. She's a licensed therapist for Meridian K Counseling. But first, on the line from Mattoon, again, is Penny Weaver. She's the editor of the Mattoon Journal-Gazette and Times Courier. Penny, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Penny, as we know, as journalists, in the immediate hours and days right after the shooting, there are lots of details that aren't confirmed or sometimes news outlets get wrong. Now that we're 30 days out from this, can you remind us of the details of this, and do we know why this happened?
No, we don't have any official reason why. There are a number of people saying that the shooter was bullied, but officials, police and the school have not confirmed any kind of reasoning for why this may have happened.
And as we mentioned, one student was injured and taken to the hospital. Has that student made a full recovery?
I believe so. I believe he's recovering well. We have not gotten an interview with him yet. Of course, it's a very traumatic event, and I don't know if and when he would like to speak to the media, but from what we understand, he's recovering just fine.
Right, and was from what we understand, we made a media request to the high school. I understand probably their school's not really talking or answering any media requests at this point, right?
Right. While the police investigation is ongoing, they won't be speaking to the press or speaking about the event.
Penny, how are folks doing? I mean, I imagine it's a real shock when any shooting happens, and everybody probably always thinks, well, it won't happen in my community, and it's so unfortunate when it does.
I really feel like people are doing pretty well. There are a number of movements to really band together. One of the biggest was the selling of hashtag Mattoon Strong t-shirts. And a local company, Wave Graphics, donated the labor and everything. They did the t-shirts at cost. And lots of people bought them. They raised $16,000 that they gave to the school for security purposes. Of course, we haven't, the school board has not discussed if there might be metal detectors added to the schools or what security issues might be addressed. But the school board did talk about, you know, several different issues such as security that we will need to be discussing in the next few weeks and months to come.
And just to be clear, there aren't, in terms of security measures, there aren't metal detectors right now at the high school that students go through.
That's correct. Yeah, and
right.
We don't know how the student got the gun into school.
And you mentioned that there were reports that the shooter had been bullied. What have you heard from the community in response to that? Has there been lots of discussion around that?
There has been quite a bit. In fact, on October 8th, it was a Sunday, there was an anti-bullying rally near the high school. And a number of people, I would say a dozen or a couple of dozen people, held signs just for to raise awareness about bullying. And they were there because the shooter allegedly was bullied, and that might be related to the shooting. But again, officials have not confirmed or denied anything regarding bullying regarding to this situation.
I should make a note to our audience, we're not naming any of the shooters because they're, as a general practice, they're not adults, so we're not really identifying the shooters. But do we know what's happened with the shooter who was taken into police custody right afterwards, Penny?
Well, he is 14, a freshman. He is in juvenile detention and will remain there. He was in court in October, and I believe his next court date maybe November 17th, but it's coming up. It takes a while for these things to work through the courts. But what the courts are waiting on is the mental evaluations, which are pretty common in these cases. They take a look for mental illness, if that was any kind of a factor, to make sure that the defendant can aid in his case, can aid his attorney. And like I say, that's pretty typical in cases like this.
And Penny, has school more or less returned to normal? Has there been any changes to the way that things are done at the high school or at other schools throughout Mattoon?
You know, as far as I have been able to tell, things have started to really just go on back to normal. Initially, there were several different activities, like the students did chalkings, wrote different empowering messages on the sidewalks outside the high school, you know, like Mattoon Strong and Stronger Together and things like that. And I think that really helped folks feel better, the kids especially. They brought in dogs that are trained, service dogs trained for people experiencing a situation like this or a grief-type situation. And the students really responded to that. So there's been a lot of just really coming together of the community and support within the schools and also just the community at large.
Right, and I know Mattoon Middle School brought a speaker to campus earlier than they had planned, right? They had to have him come in the fall instead of earlier than something I think that had been planned for next spring.
Yes, it was planned for the spring. His name is Connor James, and he was originally from Mattoon. And one of the middle school teachers did note that they thought it would be more meaningful now for him to speak than in the spring. So they did ask him to come a little bit earlier, which he did.
We've been speaking with Penny Weaver. She's the editor of the Mattoon Journal-Gazette and Times Courier. I want to bring Karen Sims into the conversation as well. She's a licensed therapist based in Indiana with Meridian K Consulting. They're on the line. Hi, Karen. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi.
Karen, I know back to normal is a relative term after an event such as this that happens. And when we think about this, I just wonder from your perspective also just if you can kind of give us a standpoint of where a month after, I always feel like a month after this event is when, you know, a lot of times the news attention disappears. Perhaps even, as Penny was saying, people are going back to their routines that they were at before. I wonder where people tend to be emotionally or when support is most needed. I think there's always a lot of support provided immediately after an event. What about a couple weeks on or a month on?
So I love that image and metaphor. So I like to think about it as a bell curve because no two people are going to be responding in the same way. So some people, for this will be a minor blip, and they are actually fine. It's sort of like, if you think about a loss of any kind. And so what we want to be most concerned about is for people who were significantly impacted. And so this would be the time that for families and communities to start looking for those indicators that they're not rebounding in the way that one might anticipate. Because you're right, this is when the intention sort of goes away, and especially if you're surrounded by messages that say you should be fine or that recovery or that strength is the thing that's valued, there are people who are, again, on the other end of the bell curve who might be much more impacted.
And what would some of the signs be, I imagine, for parents or other adults? And it's not just students that I think would be affected by this, right?
Absolutely. So depending on the age and the development of the person, there are some things, right? And so big indicators across the board are problems sleeping, any radical change in behavior. So if you are used to being social and you don't want to be around for people, if you're finding that you're experiencing more anxiety going into the building, if you're not engaged in life as you should be, those are early indicators that something might be wrong. And then on a more exaggerated fashion, if there are nightmares or night terrors or physical stomach aches or those kinds of things, then we definitely know that you should go get some help.
And when we think about the fact that this happened in a cafeteria where everyone congregates on a regular basis, I wonder how schools handle that. Obviously, you're in Indiana. This is not something that you're dealing with in this specific case. But was there ever a right time to bring students back to the same place where a school shooting took place? I mean, unfortunately, I feel like this probably happens a lot of times across the country, right? Shootings take place in your school, and there are places where you're going to go, where the students are going to go, where they actually experience the event.
So the recommendation from a lot of best practices from the National Childhood, for the National Educational Association and others suggests bringing people back to have conversations in places that are that would be triggering is a great idea. So that is actually the recommendation. But you do that in a way that preps them well. You prepare parents and the community for it. Because there are multiple different conversations that need to be had, but there's two specific conversations. One is just to process how people are feeling and to normalize any grief or stress or impact that it might, any adverse impact. So you want to normalize that. The second piece about bringing people together is around having restorative conversations, because when you have something that disrupts relationships, it's very tempting to pit people against each other. So victim, offender, guilty, innocent. The legal, the criminal justice system sort of sets that up. However, in a community, more than likely, those are students that people knew. And so how is it, in some ways, de-identified, not about them, but how is it that as a community you come back to being whole? And if there were issues like hypothetically bullying or, cliques or whatever that might have triggered the reaction, that's the space to start initiating those real conversations about where we go from here and what's the culture and climate we want to have.
Penny, as you're listening to Karen talk, I'm thinking about the fact that Mattoon School Superintendent Larry Lilly said at the beginning, he said when this happened that students who wanted counseling would be able to get it. Do you have a sense that from the school standpoint and from a community standpoint, not just students but others, that these things that Karen are talking about are happening?
Yes, I really think so. I know the school cafeteria was closed for a couple of days after the shooting incident, but after that, students could go to the cafeteria for lunch, but so I know several of the teachers offered for the students to eat their lunch in certain classrooms if they didn't feel comfortable going to the cafeteria. So, as Karen said, different people handle things differently and their timeline is different for processing bad events like this. And so I think the students were given those options that they needed to kind of heal at their own pace.
Yeah, thanks for that, Penny. Karen, one of the things you said last month was that oftentimes people who get left out of these discussions are the staff and faculty. What are important things you recommend for school administrators to do to make sure that they don't get forgotten?
So the same things I would recommend for students, allowing space for them to have conversations about culture, climate, and impact. I think it's a uniquely the temptation is for everybody to feel like you should get over it or not be impacted. What we know about from a mental health perspective, not talking about things is actually what makes you sicker. So the more you can create space for open and transparent conversations, the better. I would also, I know a number of schools are having workshops and training and additional resources around trauma-informed schools, trauma-informed classrooms, trying to think about how do you transform the culture and climate to be supportive of teachers, and those are policy decisions. And then looking at, like, what your plans for self-care. We know the best practices to prevent burnout or teacher turnover or even, you know, really, you know, teacher stress are ones that allow teachers to do self-care, to have mentoring support, and the same things that you would offer the students, teachers should be encouraged to take advantage of without stigma.
Yeah, Penny, I'm also just thinking about you guys covering this. I imagine you've also had conversations in the newsroom about how to take care of yourself too, huh?
Yeah, we have. I mean, there's a lot of media and journalism bashing that goes on these days. And but these things really affect us. We were all upset by it. But, you know, the first thing you do is you dig in and you do your job. And then after the fact, you know, we just discussed it amongst ourselves. We just kind of process what happened. And mostly we talk about what's the best way that we can cover this story without being intrusive to people who have been traumatized and yet also fulfilling our obligation to keep the public informed.
That's Penny Weaver with the Mattoon Journal-Gazette and Times Courier. Penny, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us. Karen, if you can stick around after the break, I just had one or two more questions that I wanted to ask you as we talk about a month on from the school shooting that happened at Mattoon High School. Penny, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're just following up on the Central Illinois high school shooting that happened at Mattoon High a month ago, where a student started shooting in the cafeteria, was subdued by a teacher, taken into police custody. The student that was shot is recovering. We've been talking about a month after that, how everyone's handling it. There's been more than 200 school shooting incidents since the Sandy Hook shootings. That was back in 2012. We're talking to Karen Sim. She's a licensed therapist based in Indiana with Meridian K Consulting on the phone with us. Karen, one thing I wanted to ask you about was when we first talked about this, we actually got an email from a listener after the program saying she wished we had spent more time talking about the fact that there's been reports that the alleged shooter was himself bullied. And the thought that perhaps school was not a safe place for this person. And I wonder where you think that fits into all of this conversation, sort of the mental health of the young people that are involved in these shootings.
So, you know, the recommendation is always to do sort of a root cause analysis to figure out what triggered a school shooting. But you know, historically, if you look at all of the, most of the sort of discrete shootings that have, you know, been targeted, bullying has sort of been, you know, an underlying theme about all of them, so it is definitely worth having the conversation. I think it's incredibly telling that this month is Bullying Awareness Month. October is Bullying Awareness Month, and this week, actually, currently, the 21st through the 27th, is Bullying Awareness Week. So there are so many resources about it, very rarely, people shoot for a reason, and a lot of those reasons are about depression, frustration, anxiety, and then people react out of that. So I anticipate one of the reasons why people aren't talking about it is that you're not giving people an excuse to shoot, But just knowing that there's often a root cause, that the school can do something about it, that families can do something about it, that a larger community can do something about. And the research has found that it's key to preventing these kind of incidents.
And as I mentioned, we're thinking about the fact more than in the past 5 years, more than 200 school shooting incidents, 6 so far this year. Is there any research into the long-term trauma on students?
So there is research about the long-term impact. And, thinking about that bell curve, so some students, unfortunately, are beginning to normalize this kind of behavior, which as a society I think is pretty scary for us, because we don't ever want to be in a place where when school shootings happen, people don't feel impacted in any way by that. You get how it's important to keep our sort of human radar on and to know when bad things happen, we're impacted. But some people are starting to normalize it. And then we have a number of people who this just adds to the level of stress and anxiety that they already experience and have. And so there are so many phenomenal, great resources that I would love to encourage people to check out. So there are great resources to address it because people are aware that this has some significant impact long term. So trauma, right, across the board has adverse health outcomes for people, and this sort of adds into your people's trauma toolbox, right? So, again, it's just really important for us to do something about it and be intentional about doing something about it.
A good reminder for all of us. Thanks to Karen Sims, who's a founder of Meridian K Consulting in Indiana, where she's a licensed therapist and specializes in helping communities face trauma. Karen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
One of the roles of the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services is to serve the mission of intact family services. That's to keep families together instead of putting children through the trauma of removing them from their homes to live with strangers. There's about 2,700 children who are receiving these services across Illinois. And for 5 years, between 2007 and 2011, one child died who was part of this program, and then something happened. Between 2012 and 2016, 15 children died. This was all while receiving intact family services, all under the watch of DCFS. The Chicago Tribune has been continuing its ongoing investigation into DCFS, which is now under new leadership, you might say in part thanks to some of their investigative work. They've also had a chance to speak to its new director and look at an inspector general's report on these deaths. The numbers were revealed yesterday as part of the Chicago Tribune investigation. One of those reporters, Gary Marks, is on the line with us now. Hi, Gary. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Good to be with you.
Gary, you started your story that you and David Jackson wrote by telling the very tragic story of one of these deaths of one of these little ones, Verna Tobiko. She was a 5-year-old from Chicago's South East Side. The way I think this story, I think, sheds a lot light on what is broken and what we never want to have happen, right, through intact family services. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, it's just a very tragic case. Verna Tobiko was a 5-year-old girl, and about six. She died in May of 2015, and her biological father's girlfriend is now standing trial for first degree murder here in Cook County, and the family came under the radar screen several years earlier, but it especially became important. Intact Family Services got involved in 2014, about 8 months before Verna's death. And what happened is that the three, Verna and two of her siblings, were living with their mother, and their mother was found to be neglectful of the kids, and so the kids were moved to Verna's biological father and the girlfriend, and Intact Family Services, a private agency, Kaleidoscope, was brought in to try to help this family in terms of providing the father, who had never really been a a parent, a guardian of these kids, to provide him with, parental support. They provided, rental income when he got behind in payments, and coach, winter coach for the kids, et cetera, et cetera. But, both DCFS and the Intact Family Services made a really tragic mistake, and that is that, the father was working most of the time or sleeping during the day because he worked night shifts at a
right,
farm.
Right, so he wasn't really the primary caregiver.
No, he wasn't, and that was the issue, is that the girlfriend turned out to be the primary caretaker, and she should have been evaluated and assessed by DCFS and by the Intact Family Services, and she really was never on their radar screen. And this is despite the fact that, almost immediately when the kids were moved under the care of the father and the girlfriend, the kids began getting suspicious injuries. Verna had a broken arm, a spiral fracture that doctors were suspicious of. And then Verna's older brother, Sergio, came to school one day with huge and deep bruises on his arm. The teacher called DCFS immediately, and the Intact Family Services provider was brought in as well. And the brother came in two or three other times into the emergency room with lacerations on his head, lacerations on his face over the next several months. And every time DCFS and Kaleidoscope basically said, oh, there's nothing here, there's no problem here, never looking into the girlfriend, and also never frankly interviewing the kids away from the father or the girlfriend. And unfortunately, it was a tragic mistake, and Verna paid with it with her life.
I mean, these stories are just so heartbreaking, and it's just really tough to read about them. And I think when everyone listens, they just think, okay, why did this happen is always the question everyone asks. And so let's just kind of break that down if we can.
Yeah.
The fact that there's a privatization now. You mentioned the private agency Kaleidoscope for Kids.
Yeah.
When did DCFS make a decision to go private with having other contractors take care of this? And I assume that was a financial decision?
Yeah, it was partially a financial decision. It was around 2012, and I think that they had partially privatized it, but then in 2012, the DCFS director at the time, Rich Calica, decided that he was going to privatize it completely. There was a financial crisis in DCFS at the time. I think they were laying off quite a few people, and the thought was that maybe private agencies can do this better. And it's kind of a typical thing where when the DCFS hands this off, and they go from sort of providing these services to basically monitoring private agencies that are going to do the services and do the the in-home visits for them, and they end up failing at that. I think that DCFS, the new director Beverly Walker, who we interviewed, she basically was frank about it. She said, we didn't do this right, and we never really monitored these agencies, and Verna's case is just the absolute tragic example of that, where the private agency was basically checking off the box. They were visiting the family, the exact number of times it needed to be visited, but the caseworker involved really didn't have an idea of what was going on in the family. She never, and neither did DCFS, they never really looked at the girlfriend, who turned out to be the primary caregiver.
And I was struck by the response of the new head of that private agency for Kaleidoscope for Kids, because you described how she keeps this laminated prayer card from Verna's funeral pinned to her bulletin board as a reminder of her organization's failures. But she also admitted to you that she felt like her workers were often not well-trained or well-compensated, and they were overburdened. And I wonder how common that sentiment is.
Yeah, I mean, it's very common among these providers, these private agencies that are responsible for doing this incredibly difficult work. I mean, let's face it. I mean, everybody who sort of covers this, these areas realizes that the families are, many of our families are more troubled, deeply troubled than in the past. They're very, very complex cases. And, DCFS has not, they have not increased the amount of money paid to these providers in 5 or 6 years, and these providers need to give more services to these families. These families need more support. They need more help, and it's just not there. So it's not just that the providers are kind of failing in this, or DCFS is failing this. It's sort of like society society as a whole is failing at this. We're just not giving the resources and giving the attention that's needed to really help families and prevent these kind of tragedies that constantly take place. I know we all feel helpless about this and feel like there's nothing that can be done, but, you know, there are things that can be done.
I'm speaking with Gary Marks from the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about his investigative work. Their article most recently that they've done on into DCFS was just published yesterday. We'll tweet that out if you follow 2-1-ST show. You can read it for yourself if you hadn't had a chance to. And Gary, I mean, as you say all this, I can't also but help think we're talking about funding. You're talking about the failure of funding it for DCFS and for at these private contractors. But I also think about are the failure of state lawmakers to pass a budget over the past 2 years and the stalemate and social service agencies being gutted. Did that have an effect also? Do we see that what has happened with the state and funding, should that have that impacted what was going on, or are those funds earmarked and so that wouldn't have much of a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Springfield reporter. I don't follow the budget that closely, but I can tell you that I'm sure you're aware of this. Everybody who's involved in this business, in this incredibly important work, is frustrated by what's going on in Springfield. Everybody is. You just can't. I mean, that is really what's happening in Springfield, and the budget stalemate, and it just is a shadow over all of state government, and including, you know, DCFS and these private agencies who are, you know, giving their blood, sweat, and tears to trying to protect these families and help these families. So there's frustration, I think, and anger is not too strong a word, all across the board. And as reporters who cover this, you know, I got to say I'm frustrated as well, because I just think that it's you know, while the paralysis is taking place in Springfield, you know, frankly, kids are getting hurt and kids are dying.
Right. 15 children just from this one program, as we found in the past 4 years.
Yeah.
So, Gary, where does DCFS go from here? Because the inspector general was sharply critical of Verna's case specifically.
Yeah.
What kind of impact will this have on how they handle? Let's just start with Intact Family Services, for example.
Yeah, well, I think B.J. Walker, the new head of DCFS, in some way, I think she is a breath of fresh air. And I think that, you know, as we know, there's been 10 acting or, you know, directors of DCFS in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years.
Right. The most recent of which have been dealing with other, not just these deaths, but other charges of corruption and things like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah. And insider dealing. And so, you know, it's sort of like there's, you know, but I think BJ, she does have a track record. I think that she was very frank with us in interviewing her for this story about the failures of the past. She doesn't really own those failures, but she clearly is trying to do something about it. I mean, she has said that they are reviewing all Intact Family cases right now. They're focusing on the ones where kids are most at risk. They're focusing on ones where there have been reports of abuse and neglect after Intact Family Services has gotten involved. She is looking for more resources for the private agency providers of Intact Family Services. So, you know, she is trying, at least at this point, to do what she can to make improvements in this program. And, you know, for the time being, we're giving her the benefit of the doubt.
And you're giving her the benefit of doubt. You guys, I imagine, are going to keep working on this. You all have been doing a fantastic job investigating this over the past year and a half. Can you tell us what you're working on next?
You know, I really can't, because
I didn't think so, but I thought it was always worth the question,
you know,
right, Gary?
But, you know, I really can't. Yeah, Nyla, I know. You know, everybody asks me that. You know, what are you doing at work today? Well, you know, I can't really.
You can't talk about it. All right. Well, we'll just
not that it's that important, but it is that important. It really is. And David and I just feel like, you know, nobody is speaking for these kids, and that's our job. And we are absolutely staying with this.
Gary Marks, along with his colleague David Jackson from the Chicago Tribune's investigative team, part of the work they've been doing into DCFS, as he's saying, providing voice to these children. Gary, thanks so much for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla, for highlighting this issue.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is the 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. For most of the 20th century, the number of sport fish like bluegill, catfish, and largemouth bass in the Illinois River plummeted to nearly zero after decades of sewage flowing from Chicago. The river was once home to huge numbers of native fish, and researchers say these fish are coming back and in greater numbers than they've been in nearly 100 years. Joining me now is Daniel Gibson Reinemer. He's a fish biologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So I didn't realize, although it makes sense, that prior to 1900, the Illinois River was teeming with wildlife. And in fact, according to you guys' research, actually it was an extraordinary output of fish based on the size of the Illinois River, correct?
That's true. And in fact, during that time, one of the pioneering ecologists in America set up shop on the banks of the Illinois River to understand why it was so productive, how a river this size was so productive for fish and waterfowl, because it was truly outstanding in that capacity.
What did he find?
Well, he did a lot of research, Stephen Forbes did, on the overflow of the river. So the periodic flooding that happened, that inundated parts of the river and led to this great productivity for fish and waterfowl. And that was a really key development in understanding how rivers and floodplains worked and to produce fish and wildlife.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so before we talk about how all of these fish have come back, can you remind us sort of how the Illinois River got so polluted to begin with and when that started happening?
So probably the most important change that happened was the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal opened in 1900. And that was something that they did to preserve the drinking water for the city of Chicago, which was sourced from Lake Michigan. So rather than sending their untreated sewage into the source of their drinking water, they diverted that and set it into the headwaters of the Illinois River, which, you know, worked to save the drinking water for the city of Chicago, but it also just sent it downstream. And so all that raw sewage and some of the industrial wastewater went into the headwaters of the Illinois River, and as it decomposed, it really robbed a lot of the river, many miles of the river, of oxygen, and that had a really lethal effect on many of the fish that lived there, not just sport fish, but almost all the fish that lived there.
So, Daniel, this is essentially when the flow of the Chicago River was reversed then, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so then there was the Clean Water Act in 1972. So we've got a couple decades, or actually more than a couple decades, right, of pollution flowing into the Illinois River. But what happened in 1972? What specifically did the Clean Water Act do to help start cleaning up the river?
Yeah, so people were concerned about the quality of their water and the quality of their fish and wildlife as well. And so that act was passed to help clean up the nation's waters. And it took a while for that to get implemented, particularly in a city like Chicago, which is so big and has a lot of wastewater to deal with. So it took a while for that to actually become implemented. But when it did, and that started happening in the 80s, we saw some real changes in water quality that my colleagues and I were able to link to changes in the fish assemblage and how the fish responded to that water getting cleaner. So as the water got cleaner, as there was more dissolved oxygen, as the water clarity improved, and as things like ammonia and fecal coliform in the river went down, the fish in the river improved a lot. That's when the sport fish really started to come back.
And is this something where it does take, as you said, it's 1972, so does it take, like, it sounds like it takes decades for this to happen?
So it took a while for the tunnel and reservoir plan to come online, for that to start working. That was how the Clean Water Act is implemented closer to Chicago. That was responsible for cleaning up the water. And then the fish did start to respond pretty quickly once the water quality improved. So it takes people a while to implement some big changes and to engineer these types of solutions. But the fish can respond pretty quickly once there's a positive change.
And what does this mean for the people all over Illinois who now live close to the river?
Well, you know, what we've seen is all across the river, and we've been sampling that since the late 1950s, from the headwaters close to Chicago all the way down to places closer to St. Louis. the sport fish there had been getting more and more numerous everywhere we looked, not just closer to Chicago. So types of fish that people like to go fishing for, you know, that, whether that's largemouth bass or catfish or species like that, they're coming back. Their numbers are increasing, in some cases dramatically. So I hope it means that people get to enjoy the river. I hope it means that there's better fishing everywhere. And overall, the quality of the river and the fish in it is just getting better and better.
So is it all clear for these native fish now, or what other threats are we facing? And I can't help but think of Asian carp at this point, because I feel like I can't believe we've had a whole conversation about fish in Illinois rivers and we haven't talked about Asian carp.
Sure. Yeah. And that's an excellent point. There are a number of ongoing threats to the river. And one of the reasons that this study was so interesting is because a lot of the problems that arise in the river, like the sedimentation, you know, that sort of infilling of parts of the river and these productive backwater nursery areas, that's continued to go on. But the fish have been getting, the fish has been improving, and in part because the water has been getting cleaner. So we have these ongoing problems like the sedimentation of the backwaters. Asian carp are in there in some parts of the river. And when they're there, they take a lot of the food resources right out of the base of the food web. And that's a problem for the fish, especially some of the sport fish, because they rely on that same food when they're very young. So the more Asian carp that are in the river, the more there's basically stealing and robbing the food resources for largemouth bass and other fish that are very young. So that's a continuing threat that these sport fishes face.
Okay. And it's not a case of those sport fishes, those different fish, I wonder how they kind of stack up against Asian carp, like a largemouth bass. They're not eating other Asian carp babies either, are they? Like, just don't know how that works.
Sure. You know, they certainly could at some point. A lot of the carp in the river grow very quickly, though, so they can kind of quickly escape and get big enough so that they're invulnerable to most of the fish predators in that river. But what we've seen so far, and based on some preliminary work, is that Asian carp aren't really making a good food resource for a lot of the native predators, like largemouth bass or white bass.
Okay. I'm just curious about that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Daniel Gibson Reinemar. He's a fish biologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey. Some good news, actually, about the Illinois River and other sport fish. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
It's autumn as the air gets crisp and the leaves are changing. It's time to stick your nose out and take a big whiff. Can you smell that? It is pumpkin spice and it is everywhere. It is in your lattes. It is in your cookies. It is in your beer and your butter, even Pop-Tarts. Well, if you're like me, maybe you've had it with pumpkin spice and you're looking for some alternatives. Joining us now is Patty Erd. She's the owner of the Spice House, a longtime purveyor of all things spicy in Chicago and Evanston for 6 decades. And she's on the line to recommend other spices and spice blends for the season. Hi, Patty. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
I should tell our audience, if you are a pumpkin spice hater or if you love it so much, you can tweet us with your comments on this to 21st Show. Our handle is T1SC Show. Patty, do you love pumpkin spice?
I feel it's a little bit, I feel sad for pumpkin pie spice because it's been horribly maligned, and it's really good on its own for what it's meant to do. But I kind of feel like there was a scene with the men from Mad Men all sitting around the boardroom going, well, it's delicious. It smells good. And what? It's an aphrodisiac. Let's put it everywhere.
I'm in your camp. Right. I'm in the camp of, I love pumpkin pie and I think it's great in there. Perhaps we should define what pumpkin spice actually is. Is it just the spices that you put in pumpkin pie?
It's just the spices. So you have in our blend, we have a very nice Chinese cinnamon. We have allspice, ground nutmeg, ginger, mace, and some cloves. And anything that is called pumpkin anything pretty much, it's about the spices. There's no pumpkin really anywhere.
Right.
It goes into the pumpkin pie.
All of those things sound great for pumpkin pie. I think maybe people will love them in their coffee. But I wonder, maybe when we use it in the right foods in the right amounts, it can be really good. So apart from pumpkin pie, do you have suggestions of where or how one could use pumpkin spice?
You're seeing it used everywhere, but I think there's a couple other blends that we have that maybe are the understudies for pumpkin pie, and they're waiting for their 15 seconds of fame. But one of our classic favorites is one that we call cake spice. And
what's in that?
It's a similar blend. So it has it has cinnamon, but it's got a little bit more cinnamon. It's got star anise, powdered cloves, nutmeg, allspice, and ginger. So it has a little bit more nutmeg and cloves. It doesn't have allspice, but it's just a really nice traditional English baking spice blend. And when we look at the history and when people immigrated to Americas, I'm always super surprised that in cake recipes, you will see these ingredients like nutmeg and cloves, which are incredibly expensive right now and must have been extremely, extremely dear to people that were first coming in this country. I mean, they might have brought them back from Germany or England with them. And so cake spice kind of just became the generic term for what spices that you might have on hand that would go good in a cake.
Right.
But we recently had Bon Appetit had a recipe for banana bread oatmeal that used cake spice. So it did get its brief second in the,
okay,
in the spotlight. But
well,
it's
those
a,
are
it's
lovely.
A really
yeah.
Nice mixture.
And it's like a traditional, and that makes sense because that goes into like what that would be, what would go into a traditional spice cake, which is a nice alternative
yeah,
to thinking about.
Yeah, any spice cake right. or spice cookies or spice streusel, if you see many different spice ingredients, you would just replace that some amount with a cake spice. And
so
then we have another one that we call, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask about, apart from baking, as far away from pumpkin spice as you can get, I know you recommend Chinese five spice. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, that's a really nice blend. And again, you're talking about kind of the same spices. You've got a lot of cinnamon, but in here we're adding powdered star anise and also anise seed, ginger, and cloves. And the star anise is just it's a very hard to describe in word flavor. It's just a sort of an elusive flavor, lightly of licorice, but maybe a little more intensely sweet. And some five spice recipes will have Sichuan peppercorns in it too. Ours does not, because when we created it back in the 70s, Sichuan peppercorns were actually banned in this country. They didn't enforce the ban until later on in the 90s. In fact, we had the FDA come in with their guns and confiscate our Sichuan peppercorns.
Is like that real? Is that a real story?
Yeah, it's a real story. But
wow.
They had a spore on it that could interfere with citrus. So they were very, very worried about Sichuan peppercorns destroying all the citrus crops in California. And so they, you know, that was a very big concern. And in the big picture, probably we'd rather have citrus than Sichuan peppercorns. So we didn't have that in there all along. And we want to be consistent for our customers. So we could probably make another version now of the Chinese fire spice powder that had those peppercorns in it. But ours doesn't have that in traditionally. But it's a very, very nice alternative, really, for anywhere you might try pumpkin pie spice.
And where would, so you would use, that would be for meat? You'd use Chinese five spice as a rub for meat?
You can use it in, if you're doing a variation on, say, a chicken salad and wonton noodles, you'll see it. It's really great on Chinese spare ribs, pork satay. And if you mix it with honey and soy sauce and maybe, say, a little orange juice, it makes just a wonderful marinade or a dipping sauce.
And then there was something else that you wanted to recommend to us as another alternative called Grains of Paradise. What's that?
Well, Grains of Paradise is a little bit different. I don't know that I would say alternative, but it's just this it's this amazing spice that's only been found in it's been in West Africa for a long time, but it's only recently come to the United States. So we had it not long ago when people started hearing this commercial about I can't remember which beer it was, but the man said, I get to go to exotic places around the world and discover amazing ingredients like Grains of Paradise. So people kept hearing this and calling up and saying, do you have Grains of Paradise? And we kept saying, well, are you making craft beer? And they said, no, it just sounds so good. We just want something that's called Grains of Paradise. But basically, this is a very good a marketing strategy from spice traders in the Middle Ages who wanted to, you know, have a great price. So they said that these were peppercorns that grew only in Eden, and they were collected and they floated down the rivers of paradise, and that's how they got that name. But they might not be grains of paradise, but they're really, really delicious. So they have kind of a peppery flavor, a little bit of cardamom to them. You can say a little bit of flavors reminiscent of hazelnut, butter, citrus. It's nutty. It's got a lot going on.
Patty, we have less than a minute left, but I just want to ask you about cinnamon because everyone thinks they know about cinnamon, but there's so many different kinds. Can you really quickly just give us a breakdown on how they're not all cinnamons are created equal?
Yes, everywhere cinnamon grows, it's just like grapes, there's terroir, and the different climates will produce different results, whether there's a lot of rainfall or volcanic ash. We have cassia from China, Indonesia. We have a true cinnamon from Sri Lanka, and they are very, very different tasting, different flavors, even though they're all cinnamon. And we encourage people to come in and taste, because that is absolutely the best way to do the comparison.
That's Patty Erd. Patty, we have to, Josh, this is a great tweet we just got from Josh. He says, hard pass on pumpkin spice season, peppermint mocha season is another story for him. But Patty, I want to thank you. Second generation, I know you guys, Spice Merchants, your business founded by your parents. Yeah, in Milwaukee in 1957. Patty's the owner of the Spice House in Chicago and in Evanston. Patty, thanks for giving us some alternatives to pumpkin spice season. We appreciate it.
Call us anytime.
Thanks for that. And that does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from downtown Chicago from the Medill School of Graduate Journalism. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.